There's plenty of room. I always feel like you give me so much space up here that I'm... So you're welcome to come up here and sit. You know, anyway. So tonight I'd like to speak about the complaining mind. If it needs to be translated, I think it's kvetching. Is that right? So I had a whole way I was going to demonstrate the complaining mind, but I'll save you all the whining that I was going through. And rather than do that, some of you who are, you'd have to be probably 50 or older to remember, and this is absolutely the truth, there was a television program back in the late 50s and perhaps early 60s called Queen for a Day. Queen for a Day found the most miserable people and lined them up to tell their stories of their misery. And they would be up on stage, my husband has leukemia, I just lost my cat, my house burnt down. I mean, the most horrific stories. And then they would have an applause meter. And this is absolutely true. The masters of ceremony would hold their hand behind this person and they would clap, the audience would clap if they thought they were the most miserable. And you'd see the needle rise. They weren't quite miserable enough. And then if they won, they got a robe and a crown. You are queen for a day. You win a washing machine and a refrigerator because you're the most miserable person on earth. And the person, I'm the most miserable person on earth. Oh, man. Oh, God. So the complaining mind. Now, it's real important. This is an important one, I think, because many of us have the tendencies towards complaining. And it starts with a kind of feeling of uneasiness within ourselves, doesn't it? As if something's not right in the situation. And we know how to correct it. So it has a force and momentum of power in it that the situation is wrong and we know how to correct it. And it comes from a dis-ease within ourselves. It was interesting, one of the yogis on the retreat this weekend said that she had very, very, very difficult time feeling ease. One of the metta phrases is ease of well-being. And she said that she just couldn't hold that word because she didn't really know what that meant. Ease. What does it mean to be at ease with oneself? It's an extraordinarily important quality to nurture in us. But if we're honest, mostly it feels like we have a rock in our shoe in the middle of the moment. That's just, something's just not there. And you can see the seeds of restlessness and worry and agitation and angst grow up from that dis-ease. It depends on what we have nurtured in our life, our conditioning, as to which limb we will accentuate from that dis-ease. But the dis-ease itself is sort of the root problem, the lack of contentment, the lack of sense of a fulfillment, of being whole, really, being complete. And complaining is there's a kind of an aversive quality. You know, something's wrong here. Now, let me say right off the bat that complaining is not when you sit down, say, at a restaurant, the waiter or waitress brings you cold soup, and you call the waiter or waitress back and say, take the soup back, I want warm soup. That's not complaining. Okay, It's not giving a clear example like that of a contract of that has that hasn't been completed, and you take the soup back. I want warm soup. That to me feels like clarity. Complaining is a different focus. Where life is an opponent, not an opponent, not an ally. The situation at hand, the moment as it's expressing itself, is in disagreement with us. It's basically not, there's something unsettling there. And the arising of that, coming from, mostly from our conditioning, the loves, the small sense of me, loves to complain. Because it has a disagreement with something. It both feels the empowerment of that disagreement, the righteousness of it, but in a sense, it also feels the sense of self-validity within that disagreement. Applause meter, And so from that struggle, there's a strong sense of identity that can arise, a strong sense of myself. Even though there's a contraction that's occurring. The self is in a contracted state when it's feeling aversive and irritable in the moment. There's a contraction, but the contraction contracts and forms the sense of who we are in that moment. And then we look outward because it wants to feed upon itself, as I've mentioned before. So complainers group together and talk and generate that sense of complaint. And you can almost see the energy feeding on itself, growing in magnitude and in velocity and nurturance through the neediness of the energy. So my first recommendation is to really be aware of the grouping energy that we get involved in, certainly on this level, because it's, again, it turns very quickly into a gossipy quality. And complaining, if nurtured long enough, over time, so we feel like we have enough complaint. And it's often from our family of origin. If we've heard our parents do it, we just becomes a posture, a way that we approach life. We see life as in a deficient mode. Something's missing. What's missing? Something's missing. And if accentuated enough, it becomes a self-defeating mode. So that the complainer, since nothing is happening, nothing's turning out right. Nothing is really happening to my advantage. That we internalize that, and it can be self-defeating. It's just, oh, poor me. And it becomes self-pitying and self-defeating. Of course, with the added ingredients of cynicism and bitterness, which often accompanies that kind of aversive quality. It's interesting, it gets so programmed in. I was once working on an Alzheimer's floor in a nursing home. And the people who were residents of this particular floor were long past the ability to communicate effectively or even understand who they were seeing or any kind of acknowledgement at all of their most close relative. But you could see old patterns in them. And some people were just complaining all the time. I mean, you'd sit there and they would just be talking about endlessly, just as if it was pouring out from a vessel that had been overloaded in their life. And the water was just gushing out. It didn't even mean anything that there wasn't any reference for their complaint anymore. But the energy had been so strongly encouraged in their youth that it just moved out. wasn't just that pattern. You could see every pattern pouring out. And you could see the people who had nurtured the heart. And their heart, you know, and the warmth. You could feel sometimes the warmth of that. And you really get a strong sense when you're with raw pattern without any sense of modulation, right? What we're doing to ourselves when we get lost in these patterns over time and the character development, the hardness of what these form within us. That's why we're doing this series. Some of you have complained that you think that this is too... Why are we doing the suttas? If we're really Buddhists, let's get on. We are really Buddhists in the sense that we're looking at the most difficult issues of our lives and what the formative patterns are within them. And to understand those patterns is at the heart of what Buddhism is. It's not just thinking about some abstraction, greed, hatred, and delusion is some concept out there. Yes, I have to watch out for greed, not ever understanding how that's manifesting in me moment after moment, in my wanting, in my grasping, or aversion, in my complaining or disagreement. Or it has to become a personal experience for us to work this game, not conceptual reading. So we bring this in. It's that state of contraction that you can feel it. Even though, to the sense of me, I love to complain. I feel, I have a reasonable reason here to complain about this or that. It feels good, but in reality, to the sense of me, it feels good. But in reality, there's a rub. And for a long time, we can work on that sense of me and just keep it going because it keeps that sense of validation, as I've mentioned many times. Any rub is also a validation. So if there's a rub, we're being validated. It doesn't matter if it hurts. It doesn't matter. Hurting is, we don't see it as hurting. We see it as validating. And so we'll continue to milk the validation regardless of what we're feeling in relationship to that. But again, because we don't hold the feeling as being ours to hold. It's because of the situation. That's why we're feeling what we're feeling. And so it validates us to complain about the situation, which is where the pain resides, not in us. It's out there in this situation needing to be corrected. That's why I hurt. And so my complaining comes from the hurt, but isn't recognized as for what it is. It's recognized or projected outward as a particular problem in a location or situation or person. Therefore, I just keep externalizing the hurt and feeling very validated in doing so and very right in doing so, because the harder the hurt, the more I'm convinced that it needs to be corrected, and therefore I complain about it even stronger. Isn't that amazing? Sometimes I talk about this and I start feeling the actual resonance, and you go, my God, this is absolute insanity. And, you know, on the retreat this week, it was real interesting. We were sitting in a group. One person was talking about all the hindrances and turmoil that they were experiencing, having enormous upheavals of emotion coming up, sadness, grief, feeling the restlessness and perturbability of all of that. And often when one person says that, it ignites others to be honest with themselves. And so there was about 10 or so people in the group, most of them in that mode of, oh, this is such a terrible, blah, blah. So they're all complaining a lot about the retreat being difficult for them. And then there was a person, and I said, well, now, what have you got to complain about? No, I said, how's the retreat going for you? And he says, well, nothing's happening, and I'm thinking something's wrong. What's wrong with me? Why can't I feel like that, too? I said, you want to feel like them? They want to feel like you. You see, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the situation or condition or what's coming up. The complaining mind finds whatever situation is to be unacceptable. I don't have those emotions. And if my practice was really working, says the mind that works in this way, I would have those too. And the ones that have those would say, oh, it's so terrible to have these things. All I want them to do is end. So what is it? What's going to do it for us? The presence or absence? Is everything lacking? Is everything in lacking here? When we look through our eyes, is the world lacking? And when we, everybody's going to have rising and falling circumstances. The quality of life by its very nature means it's going to be up and down. That's just the way life is. But to ingrain those circumstances into a perception on life, into a conclusion about life as being just, oh, whoa, what are we doing? And what's interesting is that the complaining mind, you can never win. There's never a time in which the complaining mind allows contentment. In fact, its purpose is to keep us from winning, is to be self-defeating, and thereby creating, again, the necessary friction for the aliveness of the sense of me. And we have gone on this identity search and uncovered something, a relationship to our living experience that allows some sense of what we think is a perspective on life, a true perspective on life, that it's deficient, that it's insufficient. Okay, so I'm pausing partially to allow us to feel the pain. Hopefully the pain of a perspective that we might be holding, even if it's momentarily. Some people are so caught and meshed in that particular perception of life as being deficient, that it's almost a kind of nobility in that deficiency. Yes, I've suffered a lot. Head down, sigh, but I'm still here. I've met it. It's been rough. You feel that? Hafez, the poet, who I'm just introducing myself to, says, complaint is only possible while living in the suburbs of God. Now from a dharma, let's move a little bit. Okay, so now we're getting a feeling for it, okay? So this is a pain that, it's workable. So let's not, oh God, I've got, you know. It's okay, this is workable. So we have to explore it. That's what we're doing. These lectures aren't lectures of hopelessness. It is me. Okay, so come on. I just feel the energy kind of. So we need to, okay, what is this? When we look out and evaluate the content of our experience in terms of deficiency, it means that we're dependent upon content for our well-being. Now, when we're dependent upon content, we're on very shaky ground in Dharma. Very shaky ground. Because even at whatever level of experience that you've had in your practice, you're beginning to intimate the fact that the ground is always shaky, that there is no firm place to stand, that there is nothing solid to stand on. And for us to take a stand on the content for our sense of equanimity or poise or contentment means that inevitably the rug will be pulled out from under us, probably sooner rather than later. That is not where the Dharma practitioner places his or her presence. The forms of the world are in transition. The forms of the world are constantly in flux and change. I cannot rest, we cannot rest upon any of the conditions that arise in front of us as for our sense of well-being. Are we together here? So where does this practice allow us to put our presence, to put our attention? If not on the forms and displays, what we are doing in meditation, in fact, is beginning to shift the nature of our reliance from perhaps a complete 100% dependency upon the things of the world, relationships, food, clothing, all of that, to the awareness of them. So I have less of my identity in the form and more in the presence of the awareness of it. So the shift is a shift away from the form, not an aversion to the form, not in repulsion to the form, but in holding the form. In holding the form, we see, because that's what awareness is, the ability to see, we see that this form isn't going to last. It's not worth putting my worth in. It's not worth leaning up. In fact, a good way to break yourself of that pattern is to lean against the wall for 5 minutes a day so that your body is totally leaning against the wall with your arm out like that. And then ask yourself, what's the relationship between the wall and my ability to be upright? If you remove the wall, what would happen? Most of us start in meditation very much dependent upon that leaning into. And what we're doing in the course of the meditation is to bring much more of a sense, a presence into the awareness of those forms, of what's occurring, not the thing itself. In the Hindu tradition, the Upanishads, it says, not what is heard or seen or smelled, but that we can see, smell, and hear. not the form or the expression of the content, but the awareness. The awareness. The awareness cannot be colored. The awareness cannot be conditioned. It's like trying to paint the space in this room. You throw paint into the air, it doesn't stick. So too, the awareness has no quality to it except the ability to see. So as we put less of our identity in the form and give it more to the space, then the space itself intimates a sense of completion that the forms never will, because the forms are changing. The forms are in flux. As long as I depend upon them, the wall keeps getting pulled away from me. Momentarily. But if I no longer put the sense of my identity in that, then what can be taken away? What is diminished? What can possibly be diminished in that? So now we see why it's important to establish attention, awareness on the breath and different aspects of ourself, because as these aspects come up, not only are we learning about their ephemeral nature, and therefore we can't rely on them. We see that they're unreliable. Discard that, it's unreliable. Another form comes up, doesn't last, can't depend on that, it's unreliable. But there is something that is reliable, that doesn't either appear or disappear. That we wake up to by dropping our dependency of. When we drop our dependency, then this other is there. The other has been covered because of our dependency, because of our need to rely on all the forms and expressions of life for our sense of support. And of course we're going to complain about that, because nothing there is worth anything. It doesn't stay. It's not substantial. Complaining has at its base a sense of truth about it. It's worth complaining about. There's a sense of validity in that. To understand that success is on an evolution towards failure. So what's the spiritual remedy for complaining? What do we do about this? This tendency to find and dwell upon what is unsatisfactory, the dis-ease of the moment, the unrest. How can we, when we see that in ourselves, when we feel that, okay, so let's back ourselves up here. Okay, it's always the most important and crucial element between the perpetuation of complaining and the ability to spiritually move into the pain is this one. And that is no longer projecting the complaint outward onto the forms of the world. Because it's not that that holds the problem. It's us, each one of us, that holds the pain. And the pain is always projected out and as an excuse. Because we are unable or unwilling to feel the depth of the hurt, we blame the forms for breaking down. I was counting on some sweets this afternoon and didn't come. Got to write a note to the cook. And the moment it doesn't come, when the recognition of that occurs, we have one of two choices. Either we can say the cook was deficient in her ability to serve my needs. That's the way most of us go. Or we hold the pain of the deficiency that's in us, which few of us walk that way. So now I'm at the table. No sweets. So I feel it inside myself, the disappointment, the sadness, the insufficiency. And this even awakens a kind of inward poverty that I have. And inward poverty is that sense of that kind of sort of ongoing disappointment of life. And it awakens that, and often awakens a sadness along with that. A disappointed again, that it just hasn't. You see, there's also, I just want to show you that that disappointment, when it isn't a neurotic dependency, is actually the crest of wisdom. It is disappointing. That there's nothing that we can, that it is always going to be disappointing. It will forever be disappointing. So I feel that. I feel that in me. And if I can bring some wisdom to bear, there's an understanding there that the forms aren't going to be able to hold my contentment. No matter how well I fabricate the perfect environment, the environment is going to change into something else, or my inward mood is going to change and I'm not going to want the environment. Something is going to happen where there's going to be fallout. So after having gone through a life of 30, 40, 50 years of trying to bring forth the right environment into my life and then say, oh, now I can rest, it's all easy now, now this is it, this is what life is really about, the beer commercial, it doesn't get any better than this, and then the fire goes out and gets cold at night, and the beer is gone. Okay, so it doesn't get any better than. What does that mean? It doesn't get any better than this. Well, it means that there's never a better than this. That's what it means. And so I just don't expect the forms anymore to give me the satisfaction. So I feel the hurt of the loss of that. And the disappointment, I hold that. I don't project it out on form. Well, maybe this form will do it. Maybe that will do it. Maybe this relationship. Maybe this job. Maybe this. That won't happen anymore. So the first thing is I own again the hurt. That's very important. Now, several things are occurring here, and I'm just going to list them. When I'm complaining, the first thing I'm doing is resisting the pain of the moment, looking outside this moment for some complete moment that is a fabrication, that is not in reality, because this moment is just what it is. I'm looking outside of it for another moment that holds some special significance of contentment for me that is not here, but I'm looking outside and I'm thinking about that. I'm not present here. So there's going to be pain in the friction between this moment and what it holds and my expectation and wants for a better moment. I'm also so identified with the construction of this moment and the content of having everything just right that I'm totally dependent upon the forms of the world. So that's the next thing. And emotionally, because the forms aren't giving me that sense of commitment, I feel restless, malcontent, dis-ease, irritated. And I'm no longer being accountable for those feelings, but blaming the moment because it's failing me. And then I perpetuate those feelings with self-pitying. Oh, it's been like this my whole life. God, if you live what I had lived, and all the moments of disappointment. So we perpetuate the complaining through our historical reference of having bad moments my whole life. So what do? What do we do? First, we have to know that that's occurring. First, we have to know and feel the pain, feel the incompleteness, and not let the incompleteness move there into some kind of fictitional desire for completion in some other time. We hold the complete incompleteness as being a complete part, as a part of the complete moment. This moment is complete in its incompletion, in its feeling of incompletion, it is complete. It is not incomplete because of this feeling of incompletion. The feeling of incompletion is part of the completeness. Do people understand that? So that it doesn't reference something outside of itself. It's just that. If it references something outside of itself, I'm moving away from it because it's too uncomfortable for me to hold here. All right, so let me just hold it. Let me just hold that sense of incompleteness. You know, the truth is that we're each given an allotment of pain. So as a human being, in the human consciousness, there is enormous pain. And we are all a part of the human consciousness. And there's an allotment of pain that each one of us have to accept for being a part of that continuum. It can embitter us. It can make us into all kinds of distorted figures. Or as Abraham Lincoln said, where there's pain, there's the intimation of the sacred. Just to be able to hold our allotment in life, to be able to have it rest with us. Not as a tragedy, not as a pitying quality, not as a burden with my shoulders rounded and my back bent, but actually as my avenue and door through which understanding unfolds. And this practice is an attempt to use the pain in our life towards that end. Pain, Ajahn Chah said, can lead to further pain, or it can take us on the road to the ending of pain. And it's always in front of us which way we go. As quick as that, we're off into complaining, and we've chosen the left-hand fork. If there's one axiom in spiritual work, I would say it was move towards the difficult. Therein lies wholeness. Can we sit for a minute or two?